You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
Hey, hey, welcome to HR Bandit and to episode 20. I can't believe this, but we're almost 2 years old. As we approach our second birthday, I'd love to hear from you, Bandits. What have you enjoyed so far? Who were your favorite guests and what you would like to see in the pod in the year ahead? Drop me a message on LinkedIn, let me know on Twitter, or email me at hrpartnerstory@gmail.com. But before I share more about our birthday celebrations, I'm going to jump into our top three topics for the day. It's our best mix ever. So first up, the European Parliament just passed a new legislation to boost pay transparency. Not only will job postings have pay information, employees now have the right to ask for compensation information. For our second topic, Deloitte released its Human Capital Trends 2023 in Jan, but it's still being discussed today. While we won't cover everything the report said, we will touch upon our top two things. And for our last topic, the letter that called for a halt in training of the most powerful AI systems for at least 6 months, citing profound risks to society and humanity. Bandits, it's a mix unparalleled, but the best part of the show is our guest for the day. I'm so pleased to introduce you to Jim O'Brien, who's a consulting partner at Signium, a leading global executive search firm based in Ireland. Prior to Signium, Jim was the HR director for Aramark's operations across Northern Europe. He's an accomplished leader with 25 years of experience, having worked in Diageo, Chorus Group, now Tata, Aramark, Bank of Ireland, and DAA. A law graduate from Trinity College Dublin, Jim is also a non-exec director and chair for not-for-profit sectors. He's also a huge Ireland rugby fan. I was about to say rugby fan, but then specifically says Ireland. Jim, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Good, good. And Keith, I'm delighted to be here. You've had some great guests previously, and it's a real privilege to be on the pod.
Oh, we're really excited to have you here. But before I jump into our three topics, I'm going to ask you, now, I'm already in this whole mode of birthday celebrations. And for me, I like the whole shebang, but what's your ideal birthday celebration?
I think this year was probably my best birthday in a long time. So in the week leading into my birthday, on the Friday, my old school won the school's Rugby Cup for the very first time in its 70-year history. On the Saturday, wow. I was at the Grand Slam game where Ireland beat England. And then I had just a lovely, quiet birthday dinner with my family on the actual day. So that's pretty perfect for me.
That sounds like a lot of fun, like a lot of, well, do I say God-given gifts or sport-given gifts for you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'm a little more selfish. Like, I like the cakes and balloons and gifts and parties and all for myself. But I'm not going to get carried away. This is not a birthday pod, not yet. So I'm going to jump straight into our first topic for the day. Now, as March drew to a close, the European Parliament adopted a set of rules to ease access to compensation information and in turn expose existing gender pay gap issues. Per the new rules, pay secrecy will be banned. Contractual terms that restrict workers from disclosing their pay or from seeking information about the same or other categories of workers' pay are prohibited, and companies will have to act if their gender pay gap is over 5%. Now, Bandits, per usual, all show notes will be linked for reference. There's a lot that's there to unpack in this legislature. Jim, which of these new introductions is your favorite and why?
To be honest with you, Ankita, I feel like answering the opposite question. Which one do I dislike the most?
Let's do that.
I think, let me step back and say, I get very frustrated sometimes with positive intent being turned into very complex rules that probably aren't going to actually do something meaningful in terms of equality. Equality in the workforce is incredibly important. And I think, again, we're seeing failure at an EU level, as we see regularly at a national level, to actually do meaningful things to support that are in the hands of the EU Parliament and indeed in the hands of national governments. So the at the EU level, at a national level, they really need to bring in legislation and other tax benefits to kind of support women more to actually genuinely advance equality. But rather than doing that, what we've seen in the UK, we've now seen it in Ireland, we're now seeing it at an EU level, is this distraction into gender pay gap. And I think it's very, very frustrating, because what actually matters in pay, and I was reward director for Diageo globally, and what really matters is equal pay, not gender pay. And people don't seem to understand the difference, and certainly legislators don't seem to understand the difference. And the problem with that is equal pay for equal work is really important. Average pay of all females and all males in a company is actually not a very good measure at all. And let me give you a really quick example. One of the companies that has one of the lowest gender pay gaps in the UK over the last 4 or 5 years since it's been published, the reason that they have it is because they have a lot of blue-collar workers who are overwhelmingly male. They fail to get women into that blue-collar workforce at all. And the few women they actually do employ are in high-end, high-paying functions like HR, marketing, finance, etc. So it's not telling me they're being successful at advancing equality. It's telling me that they employ more women in high-paying jobs and less women in low-paying jobs. So if I'm that apprentice engineer that wants to get on the front line in one of their plants and I'm not getting access because it's an incredibly male-dominated workforce, which it is, gender pay doesn't tell me anything. So I think the continued failure to understand the difference between equal pay and gender pay. And again, I read a fair bit about this when it first came out. And again, even some of the commentary of some of the report writers were confusing equal pay and gender pay. So it's frustrating. If I was answering your question literally, I think the one thing that's in there that I quite liked was shifting the burden of proof on employers in equal pay cases. So I think, again, I've been involved in some equal pay audits and cases over the years as HR director, and I think that that's only fair. You know, individuals do not have the access to the resources that most large companies do. So I think shifting that burden of proof is probably the number one. But I think this principle that every job has this very explicit salary range, I mean, it's so far away from where the world, we're going to talk about Deloitte later, right? But this is so far away from where the world of work is gone and how complex, you know, pay setting is, how complex skill-based, it just is a very public sector response to what will be very challenging, I think, in emerging industries, et cetera, to actually execute. So I'm generally frustrated rather than seeing it as particularly positive.
I love that you bring that point of view, because we usually think of it as very positive, but I'm going to try and rebrand how it is marketed, right? So if we were to remove the lens of gender equality and focused on the pay transparency part of it, right? Because now employees can share their pay, they can ask their employer for what pay looks like, and it could be just average broad numbers. But for the field and the world of pay transparency, do you think that is a good move?
I'm not sure ultimately what it achieves. I mean, I think we've seen some of this in the US, right, in recent times. You've had state-based legislation in the likes of California, Colorado, and elsewhere where they want you to publish salary ranges. But I think it's pay is such a lack of exact science, and a lot of jobs are very unique in individual jobs. So I think this concept of like categories of jobs that are somehow equal, I get that it's what they're trying to achieve. I just don't know how practical it is. And I was talking to a former partner in Towers Watson and Hay only about 2 weeks ago, and he said to me, you know, he's very focused now on the future of work and work design and things like that. And he said to me, I feel like 20 years ago when I was using like Hay points to kind of, you know, look at equality of work or whatever, and just to look at pay setting, he said, I feel it was so naive that like somehow there's this magic system that somehow makes equal pay reality. I think it will help in certain types of role, but I think my concern about it is, I certainly know from our own client-facing environment that sometimes we don't know what the market is for a role. That's the reality. So if you're going to put a salary range out there in a very, very high demand, high skills environment, it's going to be hugely broad. And I'm not sure what that does for you in terms of publishing those salary ranges. You say something is 100 to 200. How does that help? So I think the intent is positive, but again, I think some of the execution is poor.
Yeah, and that's fair. We've discussed pay transparency on this board before, right? And we usually get caught in the conundrum of, are human beings mature enough to actually be able to handle all this data, right? Like if I know how much all of my friends in HR get paid, would I still be like, I think it's fair, not fair? Because it's, as you said, it's a broad range of people. I don't know how to deal with the information yet. But, you know, irrespective of whatever is said and done, I'm really off, and I could be wrong, right? Like, years later, I might change my mind, but I generally think we should just be open to share how much each person gets paid, and then you live with that dissonance for a while. But then just like you live with all other metrics in the world which are known and we feel is unfair, we'll find a way to get around it. And I do think it holds responsibility for both organizations and individuals. But yeah, like I've never been pro the whole secrecy and the many layers of
I think just to build on that, I think there are a couple of positives, if I'm being fair. I think these contractual requirements for people not to disclose pay is ridiculous. You know, I think that's ridiculous. And it speaks to a culture of secrecy. So I'm not a fan of that. So I think that's probably a positive trend. The one I worry about, and I know you've discussed this before, but my analogy here is people and pay transparency or any type of transparency where they can see whether they're doing better or worse than other people. People love that in abstract. They don't like it in reality. So if you say, I'm going to disclose your salary or your package to everybody else, nobody likes that. But the bigger worry from a company's perspective here is it reminds me a bit of performance management. Everybody or a lot of people like performance management in the abstract. They believe that people who perform better should be paid better. Unfortunately, all of the research I've ever read says that somewhere around 70 to 80% of people think they're in the top quartile of performers. And that's the problem with pay as well, is that people think they should be paid more. My sense of what will actually happen if we go down a kind of a publishing semi-accurate kind of salary range, or as best we can, best guess salary ranges, is it will push pay even higher, which I have to say in the current hot market is not necessarily the right thing for society. I think it's not necessarily the right thing for companies. And actually, interestingly enough, and I was on a different session on Friday where we discussed as a HR roundtable, where I'm not even sure it's a good thing for the candidate themselves. Because what we saw, I'll give a real example, what we saw with the big tech push over the last 5 years in an Irish context was we've seen some of the pay get really unsustainable. And now what's happening is, certainly one of my peers was in the meeting on Friday and said, look, I'm having to advise some candidates now who are losing their jobs in big tech that they're going to have to take a 15 or 20% pay cut. And I think that's real in how hot the market was, say, 2 or 3 years ago versus right now. So I think there's a mixed bag in there.
Yeah, it's true. Like I don't think we'll ever know till it's like done and we've had years to see. I'm going to say two last things on this topic and then move to our next. So there were two things that really stood out for me in the report, right? One is I have read a few gender pay gap reports and references. I have never seen intersectional discrimination or non-binary people being included in that report. So this is likely a first. One rapporteur actually said, and I'm going to quote her words, non-binary people have the same right to information as men and women. I'm proud that with this directive, we have defined the intersectional discrimination for first time in the European legislation and included it as aggravating circumstances when determining penalties. Now, I didn't find a lot more detail, and I'm curious how this plays out when we actually come to the reports. But the second thing, and this is probably the part I spent most time thinking about, whenever there's new legislature, there are new business opportunities. And it reminded me of the time where I think Google jobs and things like that were happening, and salary ranges for the first time started appearing on sites outside of Glassdoor and self-reported numbers. And immediately there were developers who were writing code that scrubbed all these websites, and there were, you know, other websites are coming up. So legislation always has opportunity and business ideas. So two questions for you. First, do you have any idea on this whole how non-binary will be included in gender pay gap reports or ideas? So for example, if there are organizations listening and they're like, we want to write a pay gap report that's a little different, I want to include people who may be at the intersections. And second thing is, are there new business ideas that you think of that'll emerge from the legislature?
Yeah, let me start with the second one first. One of the things I was really taken with in the detail of some of the legislation was they're talking about gender neutral job evaluation. okay, so that's not something I've ever seen written down before. So I feel there may be an opportunity for some sort of an AI tool, similar to what we've seen in recruitment. We've seen some really good development of AI tools on gender-neutral job adverts and role profiles, for example. I think there must be something in there around job valuation. So if I was if I was back in the world of compensation that I lived in for a number of years, and in the consulting side of it, I'd be very interested in thinking, hey, there's an opportunity here to do something on gender-neutral job evaluation. And then I think on the non-binary piece, yeah, very, very difficult again to execute in principle. I think in practice what will probably happen is that there's going to be an other category. So there'll be a kind of a male-female other category. And in a practical sense, I would imagine that the other category will simply be excluded from the reporting. Because otherwise, my assumption would be the population is way too small to be statistically significant. So therefore, sorry, I'm a real data geek when it comes to some of these things, but I can't see that population being statistically significant enough in an average organization. So my sense is probably another category, similar to what you've seen in some of the surveys that you'd fill out at the moment.
Yeah, fair. Like, you know, as you were speaking and you took me through your thinking of how gender pay gap reports work, and it's some of the angst that I faced when last year we published for the first time, just the fact that, can we just talk about pay transparency as a whole and forget the whole gender divisions and just say this is what it looks like? But yes, like, sometimes I think positive discrimination is required and you need these reports, Aljot, so that just people keep being reminded that there is a difference.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
With that, I'm going to jump into our very, very big report, the Deloitte Human Capital Index for 2023. Now, this was released in Jan, and I did consider covering it at that point of time, but strangely, it's been a quarter and a bit, and a lot has happened. So it never came around. And then I saw it on a WhatsApp group, and then I was in a few conversations where it was being referred to. And I was like, there must be something in there that keeps coming back in conversation. Obviously, we will not be able to cover everything that's in there. It's a huge report. Jim, we're going to look at our top two picks. So you share yours and I share mine. I'll let you go first. What stood out for you?
Yeah, it's an interesting report. I went for unlocking the workforce ecosystem. And what they have in mind there is that despite many, many years of discussing that there should be more innovative and non-traditional ways of accessing talent, that hasn't quite happened in the way that I think that was envisaged maybe 5 or 10 years ago. And I think they really are onto something here. And if I start with one example from the report, and I was quite taken by the scale of the company involved. So they talk about Novartis, and obviously Novartis is one of the kind of mega pharma kind of corporations. And they were saying that now they've incorporated the role for HR, for people in organization, as they like to call it, to look both at the in-house employee side, but also the third party side, and work with senior management around what is the best design, I think, for, you know, what should be in-house, what should be out-house, etc. Now, I, as a HR director, I was advocating for that for a very long time. I think this artificial divide between employee and non-employee, it just doesn't stack up in terms of where it's going. So I thought for such a large corporation, that was quite innovative and interesting, a good example of how you might access different kind of talent pools. The example I was going to share, a personal kind of example from a recent discussion with a client, was, I think, some, and I use a very specific role. So a client was looking at an interim CEO role for their organization recently. As we began to discuss the role, what became apparent was it wasn't one person. And the reason this is relevant to this is, I think sometimes organizations think about maybe the CEO or some equivalent figure as hero that can do sort of everything. And as we began to discuss this, this was both the CEO and a kind of business strategic business advisor, and it was somebody else to reshape and redesign the organization. And we began to say, this is three people, you know, this is three people, and probably one of those people is actually in-house. One of those people is probably some sort of strategic business advisor, and the third is probably input from some sort of boutique consulting company. So I think the reality of that is sometimes you need to think differently and stop looking at it all in-house. I remember when I first, one of my previous companies, we were trying to reignite our graduate program after the big recession in Ireland, and I had just come into the organization. And I remember everyone in the working group telling me, I was the sponsor, and everyone was telling me why we just couldn't get on, and we just couldn't build this database for graduates. And I'm looking at them like they're crazy. And I said, why would we want to build a database for graduates? And they were like, I don't understand. And I said, well, there's companies that do that as a job, and they do it really well. We need to find the right partner. I think we found somebody really excellent to work with within 3 weeks of that discussion, and we get on and we launch the program. So I think sometimes organizations just need to think differently. Is this in my core competence, or do I need to actually partner with somebody else who's more agile? And you see that all the time now in organizations where they're saying, hey, you know what, we're not agile enough here. We need a small technology partner, for example, to invent an app for us or whatever. And I think that trend is going to accelerate. You're going to see a lot more of that. We deal with a little bit in sometimes with people who have gone into what they call a portfolio side of their career, where now they might want to do some non-executive director, but also some business advisor, etc. And there's incredible talent available in that space for organizations. And sometimes what you need is that injection of talent for a short period of time. Rather than hiring somebody in-house, you might need somebody to come in and do some business advisory work for maybe 6 months, 9 months on a couple of key projects, and then kind of move on. So I think that unlocking the workforce ecosystem is the one that jumped out at me.
So there are two things that came straight to my mind when, as you were speaking. One is, you're right, like we've kept, but at the start of 2010, 2015, we were just like, gig economy is the big thing, it's going to take over the world. And it's still, it has increased in percentage, but not the kind we doubted. And that is disappointing to see, right? Because we see there's potential, we talk about it, and then the companies who are not sure how to embrace it and worry about the little things. And then the other thing is, I don't know, a long time ago, I put up the I Love Startups page on my blog and then got reached out to by a few startups. And I said, I'm not willing to change roles at this point of time. However, till you find the person, I can on a pro bono basis help you establish a few policies. And they'd always be like, no, we're really looking. I'm like, if you get an offer for someone to work and help you for free, why wouldn't you take it? Like, why? And like, I still don't get it. I don't get the whole aversion to letting people into your organization for free or for small stipend, just because you have this notion of full-time employees doing this kind of job. So I love that you picked that one out. I'm going to share my favorite. I'm going to read out from the report. I'm going to add my own little spin at the end, and then I'm going to throw it back to you for comment. So here it goes. It is the elevate the focus on human risk. When it comes to human-related risks, organizations focus on a narrow set of workforce risks, the potential risks that human workers pose to the business. These risks include operational concerns such as worker turnover, poor efficiency, difficulty acquiring and retaining talent, and compliance with regulations. Typically, primary focus, if they have a focus at all, has been on financial and operational impact of these risks. C-suites and boards have only occasionally expanded their focus to include their reputational impacts and more rarely their human effect. Here, all risks have significant human element, right? Some have outsized effect on humans. Now, I found this proposal very fascinating because it was so strikingly accurate, right? And I'm going to quote on your experience as rewards management, right? Organizations continually look to do the bare minimum. And if they do have like 2-3 additional benefits, they tout themselves are like, oh, like we're the best employer out there. And whenever I've seen, and I'm sure there are organizations who are doing it differently now, but they usually look at legislature. So saying, are we in compliance with everything that's required in this geography? Then we look at the competitive landscape to say, are we doing as much or more than most competitors? And then if I'm feeling generous, I might look at other impacts and add them. Now, obviously, rewards is thin slicing it into a very small section. There's a lot more that goes into it. But like, Jim, do you agree with the focus on this? And what should we be doing differently?
Yeah, it's a really good issue. Another really interesting one. I mean, the two things I really think, my slight concern is, I just don't want this topic to become so broad that it becomes extremely woolly and muddy.
Exactly.
In terms of what people are actually doing. So for me, I think there are two big things for organizations, particularly large organizations. I think the first one is their environmental impact. And I don't think anything in the concept and in the reality of where we are with climate change, I don't think anything should be distracting from that. That is number one. And so organizations need to be really, really focused on the impact that their whole ecosystem of their business has on the environment. environment, because that's impacting all humans, frankly. So that's number one. I think for me, the second one is societal impact. And I suppose I'll give you a practical thing here. I'm not sure organizations really sometimes get to, actually there's some potential, I wouldn't say quick wins, but there's some more achievable, more controllable, more influenceable things that they can do. So one example is I have a profoundly disabled daughter. I'm very heavily involved in disability organizations. I'm chair of a disability organization. And one of the practical things that the vast majority of companies are just doing nothing about is trying to make employment more accessible for disabled people. So just as a quick example, in an Irish context, and is not broadly different across the EU, 36% of people with a disability of employment age are employed versus 67%. So it's pretty much half, right? We're the fourth lowest disability employment in the EU, despite the fact that we're pretty much at full employment in general terms, right? So if I look at something like that and I say the reality of this is that organizations could go out of their way to think differently about job design, to think differently about workplaces, there's such an opportunity, particularly with the whole impetus around hybrid in the knowledge worker space, particularly because the government is very, you know, has some very supportive plans and schemes to try and support businesses to think differently about this. But I think what happens in practical terms is a lot of businesses just put it into the kind of too hard box and leave it there. And there's lots of warm words, and there's lots of, we might do a bit of sponsorship of an event or whatever it is, but they don't actually do practical things to move forward. So for me, if I recap on it, I think impact on the environment and some of these very clear societal impacts that are a little bit more clear in terms of the linkage between what does the company do and the impact on society and the impact on the environment. For me, they're just going to be top two in terms of the sustainability of employment and the sustainability of organizations.
Yeah, and that's great. And because these tie directly into how business is done and their profit and long-term sustainability. It's not even just, what we bucket into traditional ESG, CSR and things like that. It's,
yeah.
And as you were speaking, I was also trying to think of the organizations I know. And most of them, like all organizations as we know it today, have this typical persona of an employee. And if you don't fit into that persona, you're going to have a hard time in that organization. And that organization can do, because I've had these conversations over a period of time. You talked about those who are differently abled, but I'm also talking about just regular people, mothers, new mothers or caregivers or caretakers for that matter. I've had conversations where they said, this is not the workplace for them. You know, there are different kinds of jobs where they might be more successful, but this one is not it. And then we don't try and fight the fact that why is this one not it? Like, what is so unique about this job that can be done only by one single persona, which has to be available on call at certain times of point of time, has to be able to, you know, give blood and sweat and tears to the organization at that point. But we just have this thing that, yes, if this is how our factory is built, we can't add ramps to it. Like, it just won't have differently abled people who will be in that factory. They can choose a different factory.
I do agree with you. I think it does tie back a bit to the one we just discussed, which is I think very much sometimes organizations see, oh, I need this type of person that has all of these different hats and heads and they're doing these. And I kind of wonder, is that just a laziness around job design, where actually, in actual fact, they could rethink that job design to facilitate other bright, intelligent, capable people to be successful?
Yeah, it's effort, right? And if X organization is doing it and I see it being successful, it's much easier for me to pick that blueprint up and insert it here than go to the drawing table and start. So I think we just need a lot of first movers in a lot of different places with easy to copy templates. We can talk about this forever, and we probably spend more time than I planned to. But I'm going to jump straight into our third and final topic, which is just as fascinating, if not more. It is the big AI letter everyone's talking about. So on 22nd March, more than 1,800 signatories, including Elon Musk, the cognitive scientist Gary Marcus, and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, called for a six-month pause on the development of systems more powerful than that of GPT-4. Engineers from Amazon, DeepMind, Google, Meta, and Microsoft also lent their support. Now, of course, there's another news report that emerged saying some of the signatures are fake. But Jim, what do you think of this stance that the letter proposed.
Yeah, I agree. And I would say for a period longer than 6 months. 6 months is nowhere near enough. And I think, this, to be honest with you, I think the fact that Elon Musk was on the original list here probably distracted from the fact that there's some incredibly deep experts in this space who are saying this, right? So the article that a friend of mine flagged to me, which was terrifying, that appeared in Time magazine, was from a guy called Eliezer Yudkowsky. He's an expert with 22 years in AI, and he actually leads research for the Machine Intelligence Research Institute. And the concern or the scariness of this article was his perspective, and that comes from more than 20 years of depth of experience on cutting edge AI. His perspective, frankly, took me back to watching The Terminator kind of as a teenager, because his perspective is, if we continue the way we're going with OpenAI and the others, what's actually going to happen simply is we will have a Skynet situation. We will have simply AI will overtake human intelligence. And he argues the logical thing for AI to do at a point in time is simply to eliminate humans and to replace them with a better prototype. Now, that might seem like crikey, that scary sci-fi kind of stuff, but I give it a bit more credence when you have somebody who's leading research at the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, which is a fairly well-respected foundation in global AI science. So I am quite concerned that there isn't a plan. So there isn't an ethical perspective coming from some of these big open AI organizations, and I'm not sure they understand what the end game is. And that's a very dangerous space, because fundamentally, we might not get an opportunity to course correct. So I think there's been an awful lot of discussion, frankly, Ankita, in this topic around nonsense discussion around, we're back to where we were at the invention of the printing press, the Industrial Revolution, the Internet age. Somehow all these jobs are going to disappear and humans are going to have nothing to do and they'll be mass. But that's all nonsense. And a basic rudimentary review of history shows that's not true. Human beings invent different jobs and different activities. There is a big exercise in retraining, but that's not a big deal. The concern I would have here is the risk of uncontrolled AI that simply creates, you know, devastation, frankly. And I think that is a genuine risk. Having started to read that and just picking up the quality of some of the people involved in this plea to society, I think it's a very serious risk.
I agree. Like, when I first thought about this, I was on the side of the meme where, you know, they have the mathematicians standing up in protest against calculators saying it's going to destroy math. And I was like, oh no, but like, it's so much fun. DALL-E generates all these fun images that I can play around with. The free music generating AI's systems, which means I don't have to now design my own intro and outro for the podcast music and so on. But it is very disturbing, because 5 years ago, I was at a conference where we got, I don't recall the name of the speaker, but he was talking about how his students were experimenting with robotics and AI, and how AI works is it tries to find the smartest solution for the problem that's given. And the problem they given was there were two students who were coming in front of the system, and they were throw fruit, and the machine had to predict accurately what fruit would come up. Right. So initially, it was simple image recognition. And it starts with right from pulling it out of your bag. How much of the image does it need to see of the fruit to identify what the fruit is? And then what they realized after a few months of working on it is that the system had realized that if it starts tracking the movement of these two individuals whenever it was in the room, its chances of predicting the fruit increased. Correctly, right? So if you were walking in through the door, I would track your movements right from into the door till you actually came up to do the activity. Now, I was only designed to do that image recognition, but it recognized that it should just track the individual. So it was on and observing even when it wasn't supposed to. But you didn't think of these edge cases, because you were just like, oh, like, this is the thing, I'm just going to program it for this. And then I learned that AI systems, so like if you were a conglomeration of doctors, right, if you discovered something, for you to be able to share with the world what you had learned would take longer, because the AI system speaks so quickly to each other that if something happens somewhere, they learn much faster than human beings would. So you're right, like there are so many things we would think of as like these scary fiction stories that can actually come to life.
I've been just briefly, I'll just quote from that article that I mentioned. So when he talks about the risk of superhuman smart AI replacing humans as the dominant force on the planet, he actually says, this is not maybe possibly some remote chance, but as in that is the obvious thing that would happen. Now that's quite chilling. So he basically says, if we continue where we're going now, we are guaranteeing our own replacement in the coming years and decades, which I think is scary. And to the point where he talks about himself, his wife both work in the same field, and they have a daughter. And he said, I literally won't see my daughter grow up. That's how much I believe this to be the case if we continue going the way we're going now. So I didn't think there was anything that could kind of replace climate change in terms of scariness around what's going to happen in the coming decades. But I now have a number one, you know, and it's definitely AI.
Okay, I'm going to move our mood very quickly because I think we've been sliding down in our energy levels and our perspective
Absolutely.
Of life. So I'm going to, and it's perfect that we're doing this during National Humor Month somewhere in the world. I couldn't figure out which country celebrates it, but it is National Humor Month. We're supposed to be uplifting spirits. There is positivity. The letter has gone out. I don't know whether pauses have happened or not. But before I let you go, will you share a joke with us?
Okay, fair enough. I brought the tenor down, so I'll have to try and raise it up again.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you've heard the new word that I've invented. It's called plagiarism.
Okay. Did Alexa tell you this one?
No, I got it from Good Jokes. Okay. Which will tell you how bad it is.
On a side note, it's also Second Chances Month, but that doesn't mean you need to share a second joke. I'll let you go. It was a pleasure to have you on the show today, Jim. You brought a very different perspective to most things that are, you know, would have like the generic mass perspective, and you've shown us the other side and also backed it up with a lot of chilling news and facts and articles and opinions. So Jim, before you go, any last words?
Yeah, I'm going to just given that most of the audience, I'm guessing, is a kind of senior HR audience, I'm going to give you two perspectives from my day job of trying to hire great leadership talent. Two tips. The first one is, take the time to understand and represent your culture very well so that you can really assess that leadership cultural fit. I think that's one. And the second one is genuinely create a great candidate experience, because great talent is really hard to actually attract, particularly in this market. And I think a lot of organizations talk a good story about the candidate experience, but then the candidate experience is not so good. So I think if you do those two things on culture and on candidate experience, you're far more likely to get a great result and bring brilliant talent into your organization.
I love that. And candidates are like elephants. They have long memories.
Long memories, absolutely.
Perfect. Jim, I'm going to pull us out of here today. Thank you so much. And on behalf of Jim and HRDN and myself, we are out.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.